Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
I am greatly honored to speak with Amartya Sen, surely one of the most influential thinkers worldwide in the last 60-something years. Next Sunday, he will be awarded the Peace Prize of the German Book Trade, which is, of course, but the last in a very long list of awards and prizes, among them the Bharat Ratna in India, the Eisenhower Medal in the USA, and, of course, the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1998. Professor Sen, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, Professor Sen, you have worked both in the fields of economy and of philosophy, and you have been an academic since the 1950s. A simpler time, perhaps, but I would not necessarily think a better one. And every time I read your work, I feel so much humanism and such a belief in humanity, such gentle optimism in a way. Is that a character trait of yours, or would you just simply say that the world and its development over the last decades has given you cause for optimism?
Oh, I don't think there is a much cause for optimism in the world. But I think we have to create our own optimism. You know, the world is going to have its problems, and we have to go on fighting for making it a better world. And that requires not only a determination to do it, but a certain hope that things will work out if we all work together. And in that respect, working together, I have been often very happy indeed to find collaborators and others working with me. And that has always been an enormous source of pleasure for me.
Now, your work has touched on many crucial philosophical debates. It is of intimidating scope and reach, and of course much broader and deeper and more nuanced than anything we will be able to discuss here today. But one important point that has always been very interesting for us as a philosophy students was that in your early work you have a quite a pointed critique of rational choice theory, of a sort of an economic conception of the human being as a free rational agent who is always willing and able to maximize his or her personal interests. Why is rational choice theory not as useful in economics as one might think?
Well, I think rational choice theory would play that role if it really represented rationality in the broad way in which reasoning would suggest that we think about rationality. But if by rationality people mean that you have to be only self-interested, if you do anything for others, this is irrational, then there is something wrong with that thinking. It's not because rationality has a problem, but because those who characterize rationality as self-seeking miss out the fact that rationality involves reasoned arrival at conclusions, and these could just as easily be concerned with trying to do good to the world as much as it could be just trying to do good to oneself. So I have no problem with rational choice as such, but rational choice theory, as it is called, like patented rational choice theory, what they call rational choice theory, I think reduces human beings into self-seeking, narrow-minded creatures. And that, I don't see, is a feature of rationality or indeed of good reasoning. So my quarrel is with that and not with rationality and reasoning as such.
So it is not the concept in itself that is wrong. It is the type of data that is put into the concept which is insufficient. And this, I think, is probably a broad theme that goes through much of your work, the constant search for better and more precise data to explain cultural and societal phenomena and economic ones, of course. And probably your most well-known and most influential concept and theoretical innovation has been your capability approach, which you developed in the 70s and 80s. What is at the core of this idea, and in view of which political and economic problems did you develop it?
Well, I think the idea of capability is really an old one, going back all the way to early thinkers, Greek thinkers like Aristotle, and similarly there are thinkers in India, China, and so on, where people have talked about what makes life fulfilling. Aristotle talked particularly about that is not just being happy, nor just being contented in a worldly sense, but something where we have the ability to do what we have reason to do and what we want to do. I think there are three steps in it. That is central to it is the idea, of course, is reasoning and rationality, that when we think about what kind of a life I would like, we tend to think about the things that we would like to do, which we or achieve, which is, will depend on how we see the world and what role we place ourselves in it. Now, once that is a bit clearer, then we try to see how we might be able to have the capability or have the ability to do and to be what we would like to be, from very elementary things, being free of disease, being not being undernourished, and not suffering from pain. Pain comes in there too. But from there to be genuinely happy, to be creative, to be those things that we would like to achieve because we value them. If we have tendency towards poetry, then to be able to write good poems would be part of the capability that we can value. So this whole range of things, from not being undernourished to being able to achieve those things that we have reason to value, these are things that we can talk about, and we, depending on how we reason about it, we could have some kind of a ranking of them or some kind of a valuation of them. And so capability is to be able to do those things which we have a reason to value. So reasoning is central, our ability is central. And that's central because if you are ill, if you are very debilitated, you may know what it is that by reasoning you want, but you may not be able to get there. Sometimes the opposite may happen. You may have a powerful body and you may have a lot of income and be quite rich and not succeed for some other reason, like some kind of a psychological problem, and psychological problems are quite extensive in the world when we know what we want to do and yet not be able to do it. And so I think the main focus here is to consider how we can reason about what we want and how we can bring it about that we can do or be those things, and then see whether we can go ahead and do it. So this is the way I think a reasoned structure may go. Reasoning is very central to that. We began with this question, and I think I pointed out why I have very full reasoning, but not full quote-unquote rational choice theory, which makes us into very narrow creatures. If what I want to do is to get the independence of my country, assuming it's a colony, ruled by an imperial power, or if you want to eliminate illnesses like the pandemic from which we are suffering, if it is one of my objectives is to eliminate COVID-19 from the world, well, then that is a reasoning which is part of my rational thinking. And so capability has a conditionality depending on where we are, what the world is like, what problems the world is facing, how we attach importance to various things that happens to other people and various things that happen to me. And it's that totality of thinking that I tried to capture through the capability approach.
And if I may just ask, sort of as a clarification, how individual is this concept of capability and how collective? I mean, are we talking about really individual choices, individual values, or are we talking of sort of broad social conditions and broadly groups that need to be enabled to sort of live certain capabilities? I think the concept can work for both, but what is the sort of focal point of your interest in capability?
I think ultimately it is what we as persons want. So the individual does come into it quite a bit. And you're absolutely right that individuals vary in terms of what we want. You know, it's objectives differ. Some people like writing good essays or good stories. Some people like to produce good music. Others like to write good poetry. Still others like to be successful in sports, in the Olympics and so on. So our objectives differ, but that's not a source of problem. The world would be very boring if we all had the same objective. So when we have different objectives, we have to see in terms of what objectives, the objectives that we have, and after examining whether we are contented with these objectives, how we can have the capability to achieve them. So there is a conditionality involved. There is reflection involved in asking, are these what I really want? Sometimes people get stuck in things that they didn't want. I was reading that in the 1950s, when I first arrived in England, there was a lot of people trying to swim the Channel, go from England to France swimming, and similarly the other way around. And one of the chaps I saw interviewed said halfway he abandoned it. And when the boats came and rescued him, they asked him, were you feeling distress? Did you feel that you were in danger? And he said, no. And then I said, why did you abandon it? He said, well, halfway down, it occurred to him to ask the question, what's the point of doing it? Why try to swim the Channel when you could take a boat or you can take some other thing? So that was a rather odd case of bringing in the question of, is this really what I want? But in a less extreme form, that question is constantly with us. When there are philosophers who want you to reflect on it, like, say, Immanuel Kant, one of the great philosophers in the world, you can't arrive at what you would call a categorical imperative, what you really ought to do, without examining very carefully what is it that you have a reason to want. So I think the need to examine your own mind is very important, but the need to talk with others is very important. And as Immanuel Kant also mentioned, the need to argue with others is very important too. So because you may not on your own get it exactly the way that you could regard to be satisfactory, but you could ask others, what do you want when you have a bit of leisure, and why do you want it? So we depend on each other. We like talking to each other. We like learning from each other. We like also thinking on our own. So that totality that makes the condition of being human is very central to this whole approach to reasoning, rationality, and ultimately capability.
Now, Your work has never been exclusively academic. You have always had great impact also on, in a practical sense, in politics. Of course, one of the big problems that you addressed in your early work was the problem of poverty, of hunger, of famines. And you developed instruments which have been most influential in development politics. For example, there is the World Development Report and the World Development Index that you launched with Mahbub ul Haq in 1990. Have you been heartened by this sort of practical influence of your deep academic and philosophical thinking on the world?
Well, it would be too much for me to expect to change the thinking in the world. But yes, I think we do like to think about what is it that we can do in the world in which we happen to live. It also depends here a lot about who your friends are. I was mentioning earlier about arguing with them, discussing things with them. In my case, for example, when I was an undergraduate in Cambridge, one of my close friends was a Pakistani economist, Mahbub ul Haq, who actually later on will start the human development approach and for whom I did various things, including the Human Development Index and so on. Now, these were concerns about the world. He wasn't so much concerned, Mahbub wasn't, about famine, but about regular poverty and inequality between classes, between men and women, between the fortunately socially placed people and unfortunately placed people, and so on. So I think these concerns seem to me to be very reasonable. In fact, when Mahbub ul Haq and I were undergraduates, we were close friends, we often discussed why is it that in our economics classes we hear so little about these big issues and instead go into rather esoteric problems. And that's, we agreed that we ought to do something more than that. And when Mahbub had the opportunity of leading the human development approach, he was very keen that I join him and work with him to see whether we can make a bit of a change in the world by pointing in the direction in which the world can go to have a successful transition to a better situation for people at large, better educated, more healthy, less undernourished, and living long and being happy in different ways. And so I think these are not new concerns. Everybody has had them. I was mentioning earlier Immanuel Kant, the philosopher. There are quite extensive discussion about what we owe each other or to each other, and that requires thinking about what we ought to do in the world. It's true very much even among the major economists. I think the subject of modern economics benefited greatly from the work of Adam Smith. And Adam Smith, who was actually originally a moral philosopher, he was trained as that, but he became the founder of modern economics. But in his analysis of economics, he was always focusing on how to make the world a happier place, a better place. Happier not in the narrow sense of being pleased and so on, but having reason to be happy about the world. And so Adam Smith and others in his time and later have had interest in that. That could be said to some extent of John Maynard Keynes as well. I think these are concerns about the world that people have. And I was part of the thinking about the world, which wasn't particularly novel. On the other hand, it's something which was quite satisfactory. I think the idea of economics being concerned only with what makes your own life better and nothing else is a very narrow way of understanding what human beings are, because part of humanity is to understand the state of life, happiness, satisfaction, fulfillment, as opposed to failure of other human beings as well. So these are very natural things, and to the extent that some of my work seemed to have relevance to dealing with these issues, I was very lucky, and I'm very pleased about that. Most of these work was done in collaboration with other people, of course.
Now, one subject that has been central to your thought, which has not always been of concern to philosophers in history and in tradition, which you so nobly mention as having thought about things before you, is actually the gender question. You are a founding member, among other things, of the International Association of Feminist Economics, and you have always had a focus on gender equality in your work, which I would imagine to be quite unusual for a male economist in the 50s and 60s. Where did this interest come from?
Well, that's an interesting issue, because it's quite a natural thought to have, because humanity consists of men and women. I was lucky in my school, in all the schools I went to, until I went to England in Trinity College, and it turned out to be only for men. But earlier in my school in India, in Shantiniketan, which was established by the poet Tagore, that was a co-educational school. Then I went to college in Calcutta, Presidency College. That was also co-educational. There were girls and boys, men and women. And it seems quite clear that it doesn't require a genius to understand that if we are thinking about how to make the world a better place, we have to ask the question both about how to make the lives of men better and how to live like how to make the lives of women better and how they interrelate. So I had an interest in gender from my own school and college days, but then at that time I was often disappointed to see how unpopular this concern may be. Economics has been a rather male-dominated subject. It's not only that the economists are often male, but also their concern has often been about the lives of males, men, rather than women. Now that's a failure, in the sense that if you cannot figure out the fact that the world consists of women as well as men, well, then you are actually having some kind of a failure in understanding, and that needed to be corrected. Now, the studies of gender have expanded a lot. You mentioned 50s and 60s. Those were rather lean days, and I was working when I was teaching. These were my early academic life in Delhi University. I often had to ask the question, why am I so concerned with the gender issue? And that seemed to me to be a question with an obvious answer, because the world consists of women as well as men. And naturally, you have to be interested in both of them. I don't think that question will be often asked now. I think we have. And I'm saying we, because I identify myself certainly with the movement of women to get the recognition that women deserve and so on. And that I think we, to a great extent, learned. Now, you're right in saying that I was one of the founders of the Association of Feminist Economics. I was also one of the founders of the journal called Feminist Economics. And in those days, since that was not so common, and since my name ends with a Y-A, Amartya, I often got letters which addressed me as a woman, like, "Dear Miss Sen." And one of my favorite letters was to say, "Dear Miss Sen, they will never understand us." And I was flattered by the fact that I was being included in the group to which the letter writer belonged, namely being a woman. But that also indicated how distant the thoughts might have been in those days. Happily, that is one of the battles which is in a much better shape now. Gender is very widely recognized as an important feature of human varieties.
That is a wonderful anecdote. Now, since we've already talked about gender, it does relate in some way to another subject that has been a concern of yours that is not always so widely associated with your name, which is the subject of identity politics, which of course can take the form of feminism or gay rights, transgender rights these days, but which are also identity politics have a quite a different history in your reading. They have a much longer and more violent history in the sense of partisan identity politics, sectarian violence, as you experienced it during the partition of India. And you have always had this sort of robustly universal universalist take on this, that we cannot speak of a clash of civilizations. What then, however, do you make of nowadays of identity politics in a political sense, not just in the gender issues, but in the racism debates, in the debates about anti-Semitism, anti-Islamism, all these sort of debates that are commonly nowadays in Western thought grouped under the title of identity politics?
Well, this is a really excellent question, because I think we have to think a lot more about the harm that the implicit idea of our having one dominant identity, the harm that it does. We have many different identities. We have a gender identity, we have a class identity, we have a language identity, we have a nationality identity, and so on. All these make up the complex people we happen to be. Now, sometimes in the history of the world, some identity has been taken to be the most important one, and then everything else is ignored, and the differences along that identity has generated often violence, bloodshed, and so on. When I first arrived in England in 1953, and went to my college in Cambridge, Trinity, the most surprising and most depressing thought that I faced on my very first day is when I went to the chapel and saw the names of the people who had died during the First World War. And that were amazing, because from one college with 700 or 800 students at any point of time, how could they produce so many people who died in the war? And what were they fighting about? And what they were fighting about, of course, was an issue of nationalism. Britain versus Germany versus France, and so on. And that became the dominant identity. They may share the same religion, they may be all Christian, but they didn't make any difference. But then things moved on. The nationality differences got at least suppressed to a great extent. The European Union includes people of different nationalities, different language group, different citizenship. On the other hand, there were emergence of a religious identity, and then quite often, and that's a factor even today in different parts of the world, that being Christian may be an enormously important thing, and you may be anti-Islam or anti some other religion, and nationality may have disappeared altogether. So the oddity is that there is a fleeting nature of the dominant identity, like between the First World War, when the dominant identity was national identity, and later the religious identity, which becomes very, very big, and people kill each other in terms of divisions along that. You kindly mentioned the terrible experience I had during the partition of India, when there were riots between Hindus and Muslims. Until about 10 years ago, living where I did live in Dhaka and in Bengal, there was hardly any Hindu-Muslim enmity. But suddenly it came from nowhere. People who had seen themselves as Indian suddenly saw themselves as sharply defined Muslims or finally identified Hindus, and they were killing each other. And that was all generated, of course, by political propaganda and political objective. And then it disappeared. The country was partitioned in 47. By 52, there were language-based debates going on, Bengali as opposed to Urdu in East Pakistan, which is where my family comes from, Dhaka. And the religious difference got suppressed and got buried underneath the language difference between Bengali and other languages. And so there is a fleetingness, there is a kind of fragility in the idea of single identity being dominant. But when it is dominant, it can do a lot of harm. And you know, people's identities were still diverse. When Hindu and Muslims were killing each other in these riots in India, the easiest people to kill typically are poor workers who don't have a big sheltered house and who tend to live in slums and so on, and it's easy to kill them. Now, so the most of the people killed had a shared identity, namely, they were poor, working class members. On the other hand, their religious identities were different between Muslims and Hindus, and that was the dominant factor in those riots. So I think the importance of understanding the variety of identities we have is really a very big understanding that we should have. And it is really quite important. It's not that the idea is new, but it needs much greater cultivation. For example, in the Gospel, in Luke, when Jesus is arguing with a lawyer, local lawyer, he asks the local lawyer, what's our duty? And the lawyer said, well, to believe in God, but also to do good to your neighbor. To which Jesus says, but who is your neighbor? Let me tell you a story. And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan, where there's someone who, coming from very far away, helps the wounded man, whereas the locals don't. And Jesus' point there is, at the end of it, he asked the lawyer, saying, when this wounded man recovers, who would he think was his neighbor? And the lawyer has to accept that he would think the faraway person, the Samaritan, to be his neighbor. So that was, of course, precisely Jesus' point, namely that it really depends on what relationship we have and how we think about each other. And I think these are subjects on which a great deal of more thinking is needed, even though it's not that we have never thought about that. It's just that we require to think much more rationally, strongly, and powerfully on that. And even some of the things I was referring to earlier, like Immanuel Kant's reasoning about ethics, has the strong feature of being able to ground this notion of a single identity which drowns everybody else, which is not a good way of thinking about the relation between human beings.
Now, one last point, if I may. You have repeatedly now come back to this idea of rationality and of rational thinking, and I think it is, of course, a very central theme in your work. And I think it also relates strongly to your quite heartening, unwavering belief in democracy. The text I read most recently was a piece in the Indian Express in April about the handling of the COVID-19 crisis in India, and you made again a strong case for democracy seen as a governance by discussion. Now, I think that you probably also would agree that this has not necessarily happened everywhere during the COVID crisis, but more generally, there are many voices who are anxious about democracy right now, who are feeling that this sort of rational foundation on which our democracies are built is crumbling. Do you still sort of hold this firm belief that we can find back to a sort of a rational democratic debate?
I hope so. And certainly we ought to try to achieve just that. The problem is not just the difficulties we have at the moment, including COVID-19. Sometimes uncertainties and difficulties make people come closer together. For example, in Britain, and there must be a similar story in Germany, but in Britain, during the Second World War, the amount of food available went sharply down because of the war. The ships couldn't get into Britain very easily because of the war going on. And therefore, there was a decline in the total amount of food people had. So they had to decide to share the food. So rationing and control came in. And one of the peculiar things was that even though Britain had less food than it had ever had in the past, the cases of undernourishment sharply became less, and severe undernourishment altogether disappeared. So how was this contrary result achieved? It was achieved by the fact that people during the war were willing to share. A culture of sharing, of food, of medicine came in, and oddly enough, even though the life expectancy at birth in Britain had grown each decade by 1 year, 1.5 years, in the decade of the Second World War, it went up by 7 years. And this was mainly the culture of sharing. So that, in a difficult situation, there could be more sharing. I think one of the unfortunate things is that this has not typically happened. For example, African Americans or American Black, who are the underdogs of the American society, have remained underdog in the COVID-19 world. And indeed, a vast majority, proportionately to the population, who have tended to suffer from COVID-19 have been American Black, the African American. So I think we have to see how we can turn a adversity into an advantage, because adversity could have given people reason to share, like sharing food in the Second World War or sharing medicine. They could have given people an opportunity to share the medical treatment and so on. And it may still happen, but it hasn't. But quite aside from that, I think the world is going through a kind of rise of anti-democratic tendency toward authoritarianism, which we see in many parts of the world. I mean, for one reason or another, for example, Philippines, on grounds of anti-drug use, authoritarianism has grown, and people have often been killed without trial. In Hungary, to stop people from immigrating from abroad, things have been done which also go against democratic practice. In Poland, in order to have gender norms as the government may want, leaving out LGBT people and having areas called LGBT-free zones, there have been denial of rights of people. And similarly, you see elsewhere in Turkey, to some extent in America, Germany has had advocates of that, even though there has been a strong voice, including that of the leadership, against it. In India, there has been very much a splintering, and I'm glad you had very kindly looked at an article of mine where I discussed how much I fear the way the some of the minorities are being treated, whether they be religious minorities like Muslims, or be minority in terms of caste and class. And we have to regard these problems of democracy as problems to be faced, to be encountered, to be fought, and ultimately to win. But it's very important to recognize that democracy is not just a matter of election. Elections are part of the story, but it's also how easily we can talk with each other. And you recollected the phrase, not invented by John Stuart Mill, but very much like John Stuart Mill's ideas, namely democracy is government by people. And this is very important to recognize. And by the way, I think Europe has a huge contribution to make in this. Europe has had big wars, and this is very important. And those who started the European movement, like in the Ventotene Declaration of 41 or the Milan Declaration of 43, wanted a Europe which talk to each other easily, and also they talk with the rest of the world easily. So I think I'm glad that we are discussing this, because democracy is under very serious danger now, and we ought to recognize it, to fight it, to defend it, and to win it. And I think we can, and I very much hope that we will try to do that. So thank you for raising that question.
Thank you very much for ending this on a somewhat optimistic note, on at least the hope that we can overcome current crises. Professor Sen, thank you so much for this conversation. It has been a great, great pleasure to tap your vast knowledge and your deep historical memory. And we really, really appreciate you taking the time.
I'm very grateful to you. Thank you very much.